All right, thanks for tuning in. You are listening to Gaucho Amigos. I'm Alex. Today, my guest is Dinky Dawson. Dinky is a pretty legendary figure in the world of live mixing and recording for rock music. He was hugely innovative back in the 60s and 70s in terms of creating new techniques for how rock concerts should be mixed live, very much on the cutting edge, and worked with countless classic rock bands. And he happened to work with Steely Dan on what would end up being their final tour for nearly 20 years. He went out on the road with them in 1974. After that tour, they quit and became a studio-only band. And you know, Steely Dan, they've never officially released a live concert from those early touring years, 72 to 74. Frankly, those shows were very poorly documented. I mean, there's absolutely zero audio from their first tour in 72. But luckily, there are a few bootlegs from this 74 tour that Dinky went out on with them, and they sound great, especially the one they did at the Rainbow Theater in London from May of 1974. I'm mildly obsessed with that show, and it's in huge part thanks to Dinky. So, you know, I wanted to interview him to ask him all about it and what it was like to be with Steely Dan out on the road. And to be honest, I was not sure how much Dinky would remember. I mean, it's been 50 years and Dinky worked with a lot of different people over the years. But for Dinky, the Steely Dan live experience was a memorable one. And he really delivered the goods. So huge thanks to Dinky for joining me over Zoom to hash it out. And without further ado, this is my conversation with Dinky Dawson. Enjoy.
They were my opening act in 1972, October 27th at San Antonio for the Kinks. We did four shows that they opened for. And just so you know, I built a particular sound system called a music reproduction system. It was not like a public address where the horns and everything. This was the largest hi-fi system in the world at the time. And it was made for music, not for public address and horrible sounds and stuff like that. And you felt every note, like especially when you heard the rainbow. So you heard the rainbow feel in the rainbow. You heard the bottom end. You heard the guitars go left and right and all over the place for you, you know. And that was the thing. But I'll go back to the beginning. The beginning was very interesting because this band, I'd never heard of them. And they came to open for the Kinks. Now, Ray and Dave didn't want any sound check for any band that they opened for them. They didn't care about them. They didn't want them mixed. They didn't want anything. Well, I would say it was about 5 o'clock. The Kinks played at 5 or 6 o'clock to 6 o'clock in the night. Just before the audience comes in, I said to these kids, I says, go up there and put all your gear up. Let me hear a sound. Let me hear this and just start playing. Just so I can get a mix on. And they weren't going to get a proper sound check, you know. So I let it rip. And this band was a real performing band. In other words, great musicians. But the main thing is live. They could outdo any band that ever existed in that time period. Wow. The quality of them was phenomenal.
So you were working for the Kinks. Steely Dan were the openers.
Yeah.
And they played and you were blown away by their live performance.
I couldn't believe the way that they played was another step up beyond any other band. And I'd just done... I started in 1968 with Fleetwood Mac, the best blues band in the world at the time because of Peter and John and me.
Right.
The best rhythm section and Peter Green was an incredible guitarist, blew everybody away. And I was so happy. Then I joined the Byrds in 71, in 1970 actually, when they came to do shows in England. And I was really getting into mixing and taking my sound system. I developed through the WEM, Charlie Watkins, I developed a stereo sound system, completely stereo, and no horns, no nothing, just speakers. And it was just sounded great. So that was my touring thing. But I built this new system. This was the first time this music reproduction system was done with any large band. I'd done a couple of shows out in Lenox prior to that, just to test it, and it tested nice, but I wanted to see how well the vocals did on these speakers. Well, when it came down to having these harmonies with the Steely Dan, they were phenomenal. In fact, the best show that they ever did. I just want you to know that we found it after 47 years. So in reel-to-reel four track. It's from the Orpheum Theatre in Boston, and at this point, Universal wants to put this out because they're absolutely flipping out about this band.
You're kidding. What year is this from?
1974.
Wow. So
You
this is
see,
an unheard Steely Dan show from
yeah, this
1974.
this you have to understand, Steely Dan was really a recording band, but this particular band that I had at the beginning were a playing band. These were the best live performance band that I'd had for years. They were just phenomenal.
And this is the 74 version, when that's when you kind of.
Well, this was in 72. Now, by the first four shows, I never heard nothing back. I never heard anything. But Walter knew my number, called me up in 74 and said, we just bought your contract out from Mahavishnu Orchestra. And we're taking you on the road for 36 shows, 37 actually, but we didn't do the seventh one. 36 shows.
So you were
And
working for Mahavishnu and Walter snagged you away from them because he
he
wanted.
snagged me because he wanted me to tour with him and give him what I can do, you
How did
know.
he know you at that point? Did he remember you from the 72 shows with the Kinks?
He remembered me, not only remembered me from me, he kept in touch with me wherever I was. He flipped out. Walter and Denny were absolutely going nuts over what I was doing, you know. And what I was doing was an extension of the group on many levels because I'd sit behind a board. In them days, you sit behind a board, you're part of the band because you mix in a whole band. Today, it's declined so bad because it's all digital. And that's when the thing started failing, is when we were in the studio doing digital albums and they didn't want to go out after having the digital. Well, they became digital band. And a digital band, if you notice in the 90s, there's no feeling. No feeling, no vibes, no nothing. Music's still there, but it's not the same as the feeling. When you hear this, you heard the London tape, but when you hear the Boston show, you're going to hear vocals where they're harmonizing so perfect together because they can hear themselves and feel themselves. And that's the beauty of Steely Dan, was the feeling of that band was phenomenal to the audience. When we hit the London show, people were freaking out because the day we got to London, in the Rainbow, it stunk terrible of elephant duty in the back because they just had elephants in there and stuff the day before.
Really,
And
there are elephants in the theater the day before the Steely Dan
oh yeah,
show?
that theater was an incredible theater. I saw Otis Redding. I saw all these people from the early 60s in there that came through on the soul reviews and the blues and whatever came through. That was an incredible theatre. And it's like the Boston, the Orpheum Theatre was an incredible theatre. I knew how to work theatres real well and make the sound in there, everybody. I could make people go to the bathroom with no problem. You know, but the thing was, you're part of the band because you're mixing them and they're doing certain solos. They're not doing the same every night. You know, when they start off with Bona Sofra at that speed, and you heard Bona Sofra on the B side of a single A19, that was from Santa Monica Civic. That was just off the cassette.
Right.
It's phenomenal. It's
Yeah.
phenomenal.
No, those shows are amazing. The 74 touring band is was such a revelation to me as a Steely Dan fan, again, because there's so much focus on Steely Dan in terms of the
That's
studio
not
albums,
that.
but like your the sound quality of your recordings, you know, your soundboard recordings of the Rainbow Theater and some of the other ones you did are great. So, and I think you really captured the sort of live spirit of Steely Dan in those early
Well,
years.
that's what I'm after, because the live spirit, to me, that's what live performances is about, is spirit. And when you have a band up there, or even a solo musician, doing their thing with an emotion, with feeling, with none of this stagnant digital crap, you know, the feeling, because we don't hear digital, by the way. We're human. Humans are analog people, not digital. That's why I got so mad with Walter, and then when they were doing the albums I worked on, and they changed all the console stuff over and the recording stuff over to digital, and it was you hit 1 dB over and it sounded like crap. Whereas you hit 3 dB over on analog, it felt beautiful. When you listen to the Steely Dan stuff, this one album that we're going to be putting out with Universal, it's not going out as digital. It will be an analog album. It will not go out as digital unless they refuse to, or I should say, destroy the media and say, okay, we're going to put that out as a download. We don't want that, because I want them to feel Donald voice, Mike McDonald's voice, singing together with Royce Jones singing, that an amazing talent that was on that stage. You feel
Yeah.
the real players, Skunk, Denny, unbelievable, Dr. Bebop, Walter playing bass, not guitar, and I mean, they're fun. I had Walter sitting on a two drum riser with two bass cabinets, sat under him. He could sit on the bass cab, talk to me if he wanted to on the headsets, and tell me what he was feeling on stage, that it needed different. And as Skunk would say about Jim Jacobs, my monitor engineer, Jim was on his own a talent and a half, but he'd sit behind the board in the monitors, pick up his violin after he got a good mix going, and start playing the violin in the back to some of the stuff. While the show is going on.
Yeah.
It's feeling. It's a feeling all the way around.
Yeah.
And that's the band that I had, that was really so much beautiful feeling for everybody and
Yeah.
for the audience. It knocked you senseless when you heard some of them, felt some of them songs. King of the World going with a phase shifter going across your head. These people were flipping out in the audience. I loved every minute of it, you know?
That's great. I do want to ask a lot more about the 74 stuff, but you know, before we dig into that, I do have just a couple questions about those earlier 72 shows. I mean, do you remember what those shows were like? Because there's absolutely zero audio or video of anything from that tour.
I didn't record those.
Yeah.
I was trying to tell Walter. The ideas that I've had is you record the show for the artist. I do this for everybody, even from the 68 on, for Fleetwood Mac, I was doing that. You listen to the show, you work on the problems that were, in certain songs. You worked on it, and then you had certain songs that were absolutely brilliant, and they said, and that's how, we'd listen and we'd work these things together. And I didn't want that echo there, but I wanted it here, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
And anything that there was a stray, it was working with the artist together. As an engineer, I would sit there and we would do that. And just about every night, Walter had a whole bunch of the recordings from 74 showing. I don't know where they are, but they were out. The best ones, though, is the ones I kept, and the one that went to Wolfgang's Vault, the London one,
Yep.
and the Memphis one, and there's this, that, and the other. But this one that we've just put together was actually four track, analog four track on reel to reel. So it's the quality is phenomenal,
That's
and
exciting. I mean, there's never been a show from that tour officially released by anyone. I mean, the only
well,
things that
Donald doesn't
exist.
want, let's put it this way, Donald doesn't want to release it. He's released all these crappy digital ones that are so stagnant with the playing is, you know, playing to a machine, really. They're not playing to feel. They're playing, meticulously, every note and this, that, and the other. Well, you learn from other artists that that was the way to go. Well, at that time it was, but the time, that's in the late, late 80s and 90s or whatever it was. But in the 70s, everything was to do with feeling, everything, you know. And
Yep.
if you did Bodhisattva the way that they did it, that knocked everybody senseless because it was the first song on the show.
Well, that was actually officially released as that one cut of Bodhisattva at Santa Monica. It's the B side on Hey 19. I think Time Out of Mind as well.
Yeah, there's so much. Yeah, it could have been. Yeah, but there's so much. But Donald now doesn't want to, you know, it's not just Donald, it's the Irvin, the office.
Right, the Azoff
Oh,
team.
yeah, he's not, they're not interested in doing that. But the head of A&R for Universal is going nuts over the project. He wants it out because he says that's the true fans are still it down. You know?
So is it coming out or not?
Yeah, it will. It'll come out.
Okay.
It'll come out, Brad. I mean, it's ready to go now, but I mean, it's like everything. It's 50 years ago.
It's a complete show, start to finish.
Oh yeah, it's brilliant all
Excellent.
the way through. And yeah, the thing is they're playing that night to their peers from Berkeley, from all the colleges that they went to around that area. They're all bosses and all the people that taught them are there.
Right.
So they just let it rip,
So
and they,
they were on fire that night.
ah, unbelievable,
Okay.
unbelievable.
You know, famously, Steely Dan stopped touring after this 74 tour that you went on with them. Was it clear that they weren't happy with, you know, being on the road with touring to you? I mean, did it make sense when they made that decision to get off the road?
No, it was two levels. We knew at that point that band wasn't going to be a band anymore. You see, the two Walter and Donald are writers, and they were writers for ABC, and they wrote many many songs for different people, nothing to do with Steely Dan, and that was their main thing of getting money coming in and everything. the Steely Dan thing just took off like a rocket, and they couldn't believe it. So they said, "Oh, let's go make more material, but this time we'll use studio musicians more than the band."
But when you
And
were with them, did they seem to dislike the experience of touring?
Donald did, got sick in England. The reason they really stopped touring, top and bottom of it, is business. They were having such a hard time with their old manager and that network while they were touring in England. That was the main thing. They were going back and forth all night on the telephone trying to sort that guy out and this guy out and this, that, and the other. So Walter just said, "I'm going back to and sorting this out once and for all." So he went back to America, and Donald and the whole band had to go then. I mean, that was it. I knew at that point it was starting to crumble. It was all to do with business at that point. It wasn't the band itself.
So you think if the business part of it was squared away, they would have kept going?
Oh, I if the as it was, we ended up. I ended up doing a show. Well, we were supposed to do a show on the April 28th in Falls, Iowa. See, Caller Falls, Iowa, outside with the Eagles. Now, I got there with a truck. It's raining. Oh, I didn't think nothing of it. But we get there, there's no cover for the stage. There's no nothing. And I'm like, "No, we're not going up there in the rain. I'm not going to put Steely Dan stuff up or my stuff up there on the rain. Forget about it." So
Yeah.
I had the truck, and Irvin, who was there with the Eagles, "No, Eagles are going to play this, that, and the other. Eagles are going to play." I saw Bernie Leadon from the Eagles in the hotel, going up and down the elevator, and I said to him, I says, "You're going to play that thing? It's too dangerous. You're going to get all kinds of problems with electricity and the rain and stuff. I'm not having the Steely Dan go up there, or any of argue. It'll get ruined." So Irvin's telling me this. He says, "I got to see Steely Dan." I says, "You got to see Steely Dan for what?" "Well, I want to manage him." And I says, "Oh, that's fine." But Irvin, I says, "The bottom line is right now it's raining. I don't think it should go up there. I'm not going to put anybody through the thing up there. Bernie Leadon starts playing up there because he's the forced to play the Eagles. He got three shocks, walked off stage, and left the band instantly."
Okay.
So you have to understand the politics is, when at that time, is personal stuff about trying to make things work. Well, a few weeks later, we go to New York. Nancy and I go down to New York. Walton and Donald are there, and Irving came, and they all sat down for a meeting, and that's where Irving Azoff started managing them at
Okay.
that point.
And he's still
But
their
then,
manager 50 years later.
well, he is, Irving's a wild character. He's good at what he does, really good at what he does. But anybody else, anything else, Steely Dan stabbed him with their steely knives. I mean, come on.
Yeah. So
There's so
you.
many, there's so much, at that time, there was so much going off in LA with different musicians, with different bands. And it was starting to stop from the record companies weren't letting individual people get together from other record companies and play with them like we used to do in the 60s. I mean, Fleetwood Mac and I would, we'd, like for Austin, for instance, we'd play the gig in Austin. This guy came over, this young man came over and said, "Would you like to come over to the house and jam with us? We just started a band. We just want to have a jam with you guys." And Peter Green and Danny and I said, "Let's go over, and we're gonna have food." And this was late in the middle of the night, right? And we get over there. This band, these kids were pretty cool. They were really good at what they did. And Peter was loving it, playing and saying, and these guys, he kept saying, "You got to get out on the road. You guys are really good." These guys became ZZ Top.
There was a plan to go out on tour with Asia in 77. Do you remember those plans or?
Yeah, it got squashed. Donald didn't want to do it.
Yeah.
He was already doing it. I already went out. I went to flew to LA to get sorted and get this together. And the next thing I'm flying back and there's no point.
So you were going to be involved in that live tour?
Yeah, on that one, as I said, with that particular one. But you see, that time period, there was all that changeover with the digital stuff, and they were more interested in trying to work in the studio with this new format, you know.
And you were a consultant on Asia, is that correct?
Yeah, that's right.
What did you consult on?
Well, my platinums here is, I got a Greatest Hits platinums with my wife.
Congrats.
And I got Asia, their platinums. And there's some others I can't remember. Royal Scam. that was another.
Yeah.
But everything after 75, 74, or during 74, 5, 75, 76, whatever albums were done at that time period, I worked on all of them with them. You know, just doing. It was mainly helping Walter and stuff and Denny. I mean, the thing was, it was just really Walter and Donald, but Denny would be able to come in and work with us in the studio with Roger Nichols and stuff, you know. And then they started to go in when they started flying to New York with Elliot and all that kind of stuff. That got crazy. When I got there, I could see what was going on. I says, "Oh no, we've lost them for good now."
There was too much of studio meticulousness for your liking.
Well, the studio stuff was brilliant. I mean, yeah. I mean, the musicians that they got. I had to. Later on, I did Jeff Beck and the Mahavishnu. I took them out.
Yeah.
And Jeff Beck's band had Bernard Purdy playing drums, and Chuck Rainey playing bass. So Walter, first thing he calls me up, he says, "Dinky, what does Chuck Rainey like and what does Bernard like?" I says, "Well, Bernard likes his women and his turquoise.
Okay.
Chuck likes his women and his booze, but they like to go bowling and stuff." So, you know, and seeing him in the studio, so Walter would play. Chuck would be playing this great, great line on the bass line. And then next day, I go in there, and Chuck wasn't there, but Walter was playing the same line. He was copying it and just putting his... When they got Steve Gadd playing drums, Steve ended up having... Walter was so upset with him playing the way he was playing the snare, because he was so used to...
Jeff Porcaro.
Jeff Porcaro.
Yeah.
But Jeff didn't do it because he'd already got off onto another thing. So Steve Gadd was doing it, but he ended up putting duct tape right in the middle of the damn snare. Hit that there, you know, that kind of shit, you know. And
so Walter was really the more obsessive when it came to the sort of
sound. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
From the very beginning, it sounds like, even when you first met him.
Well, he was obsessed. Because he was listening to really good music from soul and blues and jazz, new stuff that came on. You know, was going in his car. He'd take Amanda, our daughter, to the store for sweets every morning and stuff. And while he'd go and buy a pack of cigarettes or whatever.
So you and Walter were buddies?
Oh yeah. That era was the best era for me, even though you're saying you like this, that, and the other. I understand why you like it. It's because of the material. But it's how it's played. Do you see on the new one what Donald's singing on? Do you see any feeling? Do you feel anything? You don't get the vibe where Denny's guitar would rip you apart and sweetness. Or Skunk would come on then and go growl, growl, growl. You know, that kind of stuff. Yeah. There was emotion from each one of the players. That's what I'm trying to get at.
Right.
That's the vibe. Whereas when they stood up there, they're like a Paul McCartney band. You don't mess up with that. You play tight as could be, and if you break the wrong note, you're fired. That was the way it was. But the 74 era was phenomenal because we played. There was just it was so creative, and I'll never forget it ever because it was that good. It was that good live, and Mahavishnu could do their fusion live was phenomenal.
Right.
But when it came down to this jazz rock and smoothness, this Steely Dan was just the top, the best of them.
Yeah.
And the live performance could blow Eagles away, but it's just the songs again.
What was the audience response to Steely Dan and the 74?
Unbelievable. Tour? After the first number, because I'd crank it up, Boris Offer, Donald would end up for asking, How's it sound? And all people would be freaking out because and then they went straight into the next number. It was just so good.
So the audiences were going nuts for this.
Oh, the audience went nuts at the first number. They'd never seen them before in England, and this audience just went absolutely bizarre. That's why we did 2 days at the Rainbow,
right?
And we had to do that because the people were absolutely going nuts. And even the people that came out of from some of my friends that had come out from the rock bands of the 60s that came to see him and that were on the side of the stage and stuff were absolutely blown away with the presence of how they played and how they entertained people so much with every note. It was phenomenal, you know.
Was it hard mixing for an 8-piece? Because they were an 8-piece band, right? Two drummers, two guitarists.
It's how it feels good. The main drummer was Jeff Beccaro. Jimmy Harter would be doing little things, still drumming, but he wouldn't be as creative as Jim Jeff, you know.
Right.
So there's certain things. I mean, Walter would sit in between them to the drummers, just so that he would keep torturing Jeff every so often to keep him in line. Because he would wander off if you didn't watch it.
Do you have any specific memories of something memorable that happened during a show on stage?
No, every day there was something different. Every day, you know, I mean, sometimes it was like through songs like King of the World, this mobile home when we were doing that live. And that was the last number because I'd have the phase shifter going and they would all walk off stage while the drummer was going, shh, 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 going back.
And those performances would go on for like, you know, over 10 minutes sometimes, right?
Oh, yeah, easily. I mean, they had a toss-up between 70s length, 60s, 70s length, which is always long, and the new style of... The 80s and the 90s, you could tell the hour it was going.
Right.
And it's all to do with the digital, you got to stop. That's why they had that problem with the snare and the hi-hat going through, and they had to have DBX come out here to the DBX and see Renee David Blackmere and how White was doing this phase shifting thing. And it's really simple. I mean, it's just sound that's going around on a 3/8, 360 instead of 180. It was way it was set up. Anyway, that's how that happened. But my other engineer who worked for me, David Gray, just at that after the Lou Reed tour in '73. He was doing lights and some monitors and this, that, and the other. He he decided to leave doing the Steely Dan thing, and it took this concept of what I'd got, which is left, right, stereo, center vocal cluster, and left, right ear, which is 5.1 surround. He took that, that's analog. He took that concept and he went to to Dolby, and now you've got everything that's digital with surround sound, the movies, this, that, and the other. It's all based on that, what we did as analog, and he became vice president of Dolby. You know? So we've created a lot of stuff going on at that time period in the world, you know?
Right.
And using the little speakers, you know, for hi-fis and for this, that, and the other, and people were freaking out because they saw thousands of these little 4.5-inch speakers, and then the biggest speaker was a 10-inch subwoofer that was four of them in a cabinet was tuned. And Hartley and those bass players, bass groups now use the same concept of what we did in 1972, you know. So they didn't have the largest tones. I had the largest tones in the world, but I didn't use them for Steely Dan. I used them for Joan Baez. They went 25 miles in 1 watt.
Wow.
Oh, they were built by Sculptured Sound, and they were 81 inches long, 41 inches wide mouths. And these things were sweet because they were made out of balsa wood, and they were sweet sounding, not metal, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, that was what we were doing, was creating. And at the same time, I built a monitor board in 72 that was in complete matrix for Mahavishnu Orchestra. It had 20 in, but it had 10 out of channel, plus another six separate out on a cable that the artist could mix on themselves. In other words, Jan Hammer for the keyboards would have a box with six knobs on it, and it could mix the six sends that he wanted for in stereo, either in his headsets or in the wedges behind him, you know. So we could do that with Michael McDonald and the monitor. That's why the monitor board could the monitor could you could sit there and play your violin with the monitor board, because it was that quality, that the highest quality that could was made. And yet it was a big old tank, you know, that kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
And but it was how people created, and that's what we were after, is give their essence on each day that we did, you know. And Donald would sit down there and start playing his stuff and absolutely flip out, because it was in, as soon as he sat there, he was ready to go. He didn't have to ask for more volume. He didn't have to ask for this, that, and the other. It was already tuned,
What did you
already.
think of Donald's like live performance? You know, what did you think of his sort of stage presence and his, you know, his character on stage? Was he a good front man?
In 74, he was great because he was still honing his way of doing stuff live, because he was so used to doing stuff in the studio, see. So, but at the same time, he'd change his mind over to do the other, and it was more taxing than the studio, because it was number after the number straight away, you know. When he got Michael in there, Michael McDonald, I mean, it was just heaven for Donald. He couldn't believe it with the voice like Michael McDonald, and he just couldn't believe it. And so they'd work together on doing some really good stuff.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We're glad you made it here tonight, because you're gonna miss out. You can tell your friend tomorrow that they're gonna miss out on a damn good thing we're gonna give you tonight. Yeah, right on. What we gonna give you tonight, it'll be down to the nitty gritty. Yeah. You can tell all your friends way over in hell, I don't care. You can tell them in over in Watts. You can tell them they met, you can tell them tonight that Santa Monica had been definitely set on fire. And they met out on a damn good thing. The best thing ever happened to Santa Monica is gonna be here tonight.
Yeah, Jerome was a terrible driver. He crashed the first day, knocked down after the college's main doors going into this big 20,000 seater building with the truck. Showed up 7 or 8 o'clock at night. The next day he's took off, and we're doing, I think it wasn't the next day, but later on we're doing Cleveland. Now, you know, north here, there is a lot of bridges that are not more than, you know, you can't get trucks underneath them. Well, he ended up going on one of them roads, ripped off the top of the truck, you know. That's when he got fired and sent back to Los Angeles, and we had another truck driver in with another truck and this, that, and the other, and that turned out to be fine, you know.
Okay.
But when he came back into Santa Monica that day, he was drunk as a skunk, and
oh yeah,
with a big bottle in a paper bag, like a Bowery guy, you know.
Okay.
And so Walter goes up to him. We got to tell Jerome. Jerome, get him off on there and have him introduce us, Stevie Dan or whatever. So
that was Walter's idea to have Jerome do the intro.
Oh yeah, because he was so drunk. You know, I mean that.
So Walter thought it would be funny if this drunk guy, you know,
of course,
was a gag.
Well, and he gets up there and does his thing, and after he's done this, they sit him down in the back and let him watch the show, and what have you. And he's so happy he can't believe it, but he's so drunk it's just unbelievable. So that was the last time we saw him, but he was a true character that shouldn't have been driving.
He is here tonight. Mr. Magnificent One is here. The beautiful one is here. You little old pretty one, he here too. You know, whatever. Here is the magnificent one, the one and only one, Mr. Steely Dan and whatever.
April 4th, 1974, Asheville, North Carolina College Gym, and that's where he ripped down the door.
Oh, yeah, that was the show where the doors came.
We actually got one of the local bands set up, and they played. I got them a quick sound check. They played for the audience, and then we if he hadn't been there at 7 o'clock, we were going to use the other band's gear, you know, and call on campus to see if we can get a keyboard for Mike McDonald, you know, that kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
So we were innovative, let's put it that way. But when it came in and we had everything set up in 15 minutes, the audience went nuts because we stayed and we just played until the end of after midnight or whatever it was. We didn't care at that point, you know.
Yeah, of course.
Here, let's play. Let's have fun, you know.
Yeah. Great.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you like that material from that time. I know you like the newer stuff, but at the same time, you gotta listen to some of this and the original stuff that they did. It was just phenomenal.
Yeah, and I hope Universal does, you know, go
for it. It'll come out. It will come out at some point, whether Universal does it. But they want to do it, and it's just a matter of whether Irving and Irving's team in there say, you know, Donald's going to let it come. Donald doesn't want anything out from, and yet it's like all these albums come out from people that are just recording it.
Yeah, he doesn't like that, right? He wants complete control over whatever gets released, and I think for him, those early 70s shows, there wasn't enough of his, you know, sonic input or something.
Well, he might say that there was plenty input from Donald. I mean,
yeah,
Donald had a, you know, I mean, it was both Walter and Donald, but Walter was running the show because Donald didn't want to.
Yeah, well, Donald just was focused on getting the performance, you know.
Exactly, exactly. And whereas Walter would run everything, and everybody would look up to Walter more than Donald.
Really.
Well, of course, because they were talking to him all the time. They weren't talking to Donald. Donald was doing his thing with the vocals, and with each word he would be, feeling, and this, that, and the other. And he was more interested in getting that right than anything else. And so Walter would take on everything else. Walter was the key for everything to do with Steely Dan. He just knew. So he felt it with his feelings, so much incredible stuff. And it was it's so sad that he's gone already.
Yeah.
But even Nightbump, who I've known for years and stuff, who did Aerosmith and this, that, and the other in the 70s, he just couldn't stop working with Walter because he don't work with the new with Donald. He won't work with Donald, but he work with Walter, and Walter just got guitars from him and got this, that, and the other, because they were, because Don Nightbomb was into his guitars and this, that, and the other, as well as making sure the sound was good and what have you. The sound was always good, as you know. But again, is it feel good? Well, it sounds good. That's difference in feeling every note from everyone individually. And then when you see them all collectively, you close your eyes. You listen to this whole thing and you're going, wow, they're all in sync together. But then when you open your eyes and you look at them and they're all playing the individual stuff, they're having such a good time. They're
Yeah.
smiling, they're laughing, they're jumping around or doing whatever to get their vibe going and stuff, Skunk especially. And then
Yeah.
they would stand there and play bebop and destroy people. It was just so good.
Yeah, so you love Skunk and Denny. How about Royce?
Royce Jones was a phenomenal. He was singing, he played the congas and this, that, and the other, but his voice fit them guys so well. I mean, him and Mike McDonald, put them two together on a thing, just really, really, really good stuff,
Yeah, that's great.
I can't say any more about them than. The time I had with them was just, I enjoyed every minute of it.